Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Adam Ragusea, in this week for Anthony Brooks.
So we're just around the corner from the start of another fall semester. Here's a fact incoming college freshmen are not likely to see in their orientation packets.
You, the lucky class of 2015, you are about to become members of one of the most indebted generations of Americans ever. Student loan debt is pushing $1 trillion. That's more than what all American households combined owe on their credit cards.
And as with credit cards, the student loan default rate is rising, while the prospects for a decent job to pay down those loans seems to be ever diminishing.
And all of this is particularly dire for minority students. African Americans, for example, face the following triple whammy. They're more likely to have high student loan debts, they're 5 times more likely to default than white students, and unemployment for Black Americans far outpaces the national average.
So, today's talker. First it was housing, now the next bubble could be student loans. And if that bubble bursts, it could hit minority students especially hard. What should we do about it? Listeners, some questions for you in particular. What do you make of the high default rate amongst minority students? Are you a student with, say, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 or more in loans, and how do you plan on paying it off? And when it comes to achieving the American dream, there have always been two benchmarks: owning your own house and going to college. So what does it mean for minorities and the country that a bursting student loan bubble could be collapsing especially hard around minorities? You know, they got hit hard with housing, too. So give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, as always, at Radio Boston. Well, joining me now is Dara Sharif, a freelance journalist who recently wrote an article for The Root magazine about exactly this topic. She joins us from the Argo Network in New York City. Welcome to Radio Boston, Dara.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to hear from a number of other voices who have been taking a close look at higher education in the remainder of this segment. But Dara, if I could just first start with you. You wrote this article for The Root in particular because of a recent report from Moody's Analytics that talked about student loans. Can you just give us your sense as to what the picture looks like nationwide for minority students in particular and their debt burden?
Well, thank you. Moody's Analytics, back in July, issued a report basically saying that, in general, students being unable to pay back their loans could be the cause of the next economic crisis in the United States. At the same time that's coming out, we also get data from the Education Department that finds the default rates overall are on the rise nationwide. Mm-hmm. And in particular, the particular concern about for-profit proprietary schools, like trade schools, online universities, and the like, where default rates for those students is like 11.6%.
And those institutions are of particular interest because minorities make up some 54-55% of the students who go there.
Correct. And at the same time, we have the unemployment rates for particularly Black Americans almost double that of the national rate, which is about 9%. And for African Americans, it's about 15%. So you can see they have numerous factors all happening at the same time that can definitely add up to an issue where as more students are taking on student loans, but then perhaps being unable to find jobs after graduation to be able to repay these loans, you know, that's the type of data that has Moody's concerned.
Mm. And with student loans, as many people are probably familiar with, it's the one type of loan that you can't escape even in bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So and the long-term implications of having such a high debt load really are lifelong in many of these cases.
True. I mean, you know, I'm sure there's many people that you know, that I know, I talk to some people who, you know, 20 years or more away from their undergraduate graduations, they're still paying on their student student loan. Now, that's not a bad thing, particularly. I mean, they're not in default. They are paying. And some of the good things about student loan debt is that in addition to having very low interest rates, there are a lot of options in terms of repayment, including repayment plans that deal with that are based on exactly what your income actually is. And the options to do things like defer, which is putting off payment until a later date.
Mm-hmm. Well, in your article in The Root, you talked to three students who were trying to cope with this in particular.
Right.
And it's really a wonderful article. And listeners, you can get them. You can read it in detail at our website. There's a link to it at radioboston.org. But Dara, I was wondering if you might be able to just take us through the example of one of those students and how she's trying to deal with it. Amanda Winston, who's a junior at Temple in Philadelphia.
Amanda was, I mean, all of my, all the people who shared their stories, I really appreciated that they did so, and they had wonderful stories. Amanda was definitely a real go-getter. She will be a junior at Temple in Philadelphia, and this coming September. And she is really looking at the PR public relations field. And what she's doing in terms of understanding that, this, you know, this debt load could be a real issue, she's doing what she can right now in terms of networking, getting real-world experience on the workforce in terms of internships, making those really needed connections now while she's still a student, because she really understands the importance of the old adage that sometimes who you know is as important, if not more important, than what you know. And she's very focused about that and really understands that concept.
Well, and she doesn't, I mean, she expects to be some $20,000 in debt when she graduates, but she is trying not to waste any time in even paying off those loans. You write that she's juggling three jobs and an internship this summer to keep her head above water. I mean, that seems a lot on top of a full class load.
Well, you know, that's, you know, and she represents not only her, but also Tiffany Black, who is definitely, that was her, that's her tack. Like, she wants to pay off the loans while she's still a student. Whereas for Amanda, this is about survival. You know, in addition to having the tuition costs of Temple University, she also is responsible for her own room and board and books.
Right.
So in addition to taking out loans to pay for tuition, she still has to come up out of pocket for the cost of, you know, eating, paying rent, utilities, her books. So like this summer, she did juggle those part-time jobs, but she also did this unpaid internship because that's where she felt like, okay, that's what I need to do to further make better my chances of getting employed in the field that I want to be employed in post-graduation. So as she says, she gets little sleep.
Yeah,
definitely.
So really, it's the only thing left to give up. Dara Sharif, stand by for just a moment. We are talking about the impending possible student loan bubble and how that could have a disproportionate effect on minority students who may have to borrow at higher higher values, higher rates, and may be defaulting at higher rates than other students in the United States, and really what that means for the status of higher education in America. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're especially interested in hearing from minority students and how, you know, how much debt you're incurring to go to college and how you plan on paying it off and what are the challenges that you see ahead of you. Dara Sharif is my guest. She's a author or journalist at The Root, and she recently wrote about this issue. Let me introduce a couple more people into the conversation as I have a moment to do so. Joseph Moore, he is the president of Lesley University. Welcome to Radio Boston, Mr. Moore.
Nice to be here.
Also with us is Claudia Dreyfus. She is a writer for the New York Times Science Section and co-author of Higher Education, How Colleges Are Wasting Our Money and Failing Our Kids and What We Can Do About It. Claudia Dreyfus, welcome to you.
glad to be here. This is an important discussion.
I'm very glad to have you. We're going to bring in another voice a little later to sort of talk about the lifelong effects of this student loan debt. But Mr. Moore, let me start with you. Can you tell me what you're seeing at Lesley in terms of the amount of debt that students are taking up and the challenges that the minority students especially may be having in terms of paying off that debt to get the education that they're getting at Lesley?
The average debt at Lesley is close to the case study that you just discussed of Amanda Winston. It's, depending upon the statistics, slightly below, slightly above $20,000. And I think to a large degree, people like Amanda Winston are actually poster childs for the efficacy of loan systems. To get a bachelor's degree with her experience that she's having there and graduate with a debt of, if she did a 10-year payback at current rates, it's below $200 a month, presuming, and it's fixed, various repayment options. So I think to a large degree what we're concerned about is not just students of color, but basically working class students around the country, regardless of color, are hitting a disproportionate burden here and bias in the financial aid system, which was documented in the Moody's report that you referenced, as well as other national data coming out. It is a significant challenge. Disproportionately, they're going to community colleges and proprietary institutions. Disproportionately, they are not completing their college degree, which is the real tragedy of this loan problem.
Right.
Is when somebody does not complete the degree and they walk away with any level of debt. But someone such as Amanda, who completes a good program with great internships at Temple and has, in essence, a loan value equivalent to a car, I suspect that bachelor's degree from Temple is going to be a lot more worthwhile than a car loan.
Well, let me ask you about the students in particular at Lesley, because you know, it has a very strong, obviously, teaching and education-based curriculum there. And you know, depending on where you go and what you teach, that you know, there's a wide range of salaries to come out the other end. And so one of the issues is that the jobs that people are getting after their 4 years or plus of education, even at $200 a month for some people, that's a pretty big repayment to have to be sure to have every single month.
It's not insignificant, but it beats the options if they didn't have the college degree. So I'm talking about value.
May
I Ms. Dreyfus, just one second. Let me have Mr. Moore finish his answer, then I'll turn right to you, I promise.
So I think it's the value proposition that is made, and I mean in specific ways, not in salesmanship ways, to students and their families, and how clear we can be, how clear we can be about the debt. But this is, you've highlighted another point that potentially is up for discussion, which is how does perceived loan debt influence student choice of major? So we have a lot of students who are uncertain about the major because of this prospect of perceived debt and what potential earnings they'll be able to make once they graduate.
Claudia Dreyfus, please go ahead.
Yes, I think we may be losing track of the larger issue with student loans, and that is a moral question. In terms, which is a complicated moral question, in terms of why are we indebting such large numbers of young people at age 18 with huge, huge loans because the price of higher education has skyrocketed and is skyrocketing at levels that are similar to the healthcare system, and no one's putting a plug on it. The problem is, unfortunately, that the schools have not been cutting down. I mean, when Andrew Hacker and I wrote our book, Higher Education, we traveled to dozens and dozens upon colleges. All of them were raising tuition, not just because their endowments had tanked during the financial meltdown, but because of added amenities, because of fairly high faculty salaries for the tenured, and because of building programs, because of the same kinds of issues we have in the healthcare system, where there are just increases without cap.
Yeah, I've heard many people call it sort of the facilities and arms race in higher education, and sort of the talent that, arms race as well.
That clearly is going on. And the students who take loans are the students who are not wealthy, who do not have the means to just do it themselves. That's part of the picture, but we've also become a society where everyone takes loans. And we've been told that these loans are sort of very benign and that there are low interest rates. So you have something like at a school where the student population is quite wealthy, NYU, mm-hmm. 70% of the students taking loans. But tuition's going to be $53,000 a year, including room and board.
Well, Claudia Dreyfus, let me ask you, I'd love to hear
both.
Well,
nobody can afford that unless you're the child, for instance, of a brain surgeon.
But there's a question I want to throw to you, and also I'd love to hear what Dara Sharif and Joseph Moore have to say. But it kind of harkens back to what I was asking earlier, that in the United States, a college education, from all the data that I can understand, still seems to be one of the most important factors in terms of lifetime earning,
especially
amongst minority students.
It is the difference between being middle class and not, but does it have to be as expensive as it is? And I think not. And do students have to indebt themselves to get there? I think not. I think we've come to accept this ever-increasing cost because the schools have the key to being middle class. Let me tell you a story which I think fits into what Daria is writing about. The medical assistant at a physician I go to went to NYU. She's African-American. She was pre-med. She graduated. She thought she had a full tuition scholarship. She graduated with something like $70,000 in debt. I asked, how can this happen? We sat down with paper and pencil. She showed me how.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't the kind of scholarship she thought it was. Teaching, it was work study, but she felt the teaching wasn't that good. She couldn't maintain herself at it. And work, she had to take out loans. Fees went up. Lo and behold, the advice her parents gave her, which was a private education is better than a public one, turned out to be a very, very bad idea. She graduated with $60,000 in loans. It's now been put off, and she has $70,000. But working as a medical assistant.
Yeah, it seems like
medical school, unfortunately.
It does seem like a huge mountain to climb. But Claudia Dreyfus, stand by, because I want to turn a question to Joseph Moore, and Dara Sharif, I want to get you back in the conversation.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But you know, Mr. Moore, I was reading that, for example, recently there was a case study of six historically black colleges and universities in Texas in particular who were very keen to try and get the reins back on the amount of debt that their students were incurring. And they were doing things such as working with consultants, lenders, and agencies to improve communication with former students about what they will have to repay in the long run. They packaged financial aid more strategically. They limited the amount of loans and in student awards, and they also counseled students who wanted to borrow more on the dangers of too much debt. This is at some historically black colleges in Texas. Is that something that's happening in Lesley, and something that should be happening in more colleges overall? That the colleges themselves should be telling students, wait, maybe you shouldn't be taking $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 in loans.
Absolutely. And I think the point about constraining college costs is also obviously quite relevant. But I think the communications that we've got, the use of data to inform ourselves as the educational provider so we know the trends of our students is really important. But it's also important to avoid the generalizations of this conversation, not represented or presidents of community colleges, public regional colleges that serve the vast number of low-income students where the debt levels are much, much less. Now, the challenge is there is the combined cost of places such as Lesley and other institutions, private institutions in this region, are high. And now we have increasing public college costs because of the decline in state appropriation mm-hmm. support. So that is also being passed on to the student. Again, it's going to hit working-class students more as those public college public costs go up. But I think information, I also think there's other advice we can give students. There's no reason for all students to think that a four-year degree is the equivalent of a bachelor's degree. You can do a bachelor's degree sooner. Some students do it. Some of us are looking at ways where students don't waste as much time in between semesters, where they can take courses during the summer at a lower summer rate. They enter the workforce or graduate school a year earlier, which is significant savings. So I think there are strategies we can do to constrain cost, communicate, and provide alternative options that are no longer idiosyncratic, but have institutional support behind them.
Dara Sharif, let me get you back in here. Your thoughts.
Yeah, a couple of things. I think that I agree that it is, we shouldn't make overgeneralizations. I think to say or to suggest in any way that a college education perhaps should be avoided by students or definitely certain populations of students, I think would be a mistake given the data that shows that those who have associates, bachelors, masters, doctorates make far more in salary over the long term than those who have no such degrees, or worse yet, don't graduate from high school at
all. Yeah, the difference between college graduates and those who don't graduate from high school can be $1 million in lifetime's earnings. It's a huge amount. Yeah,
and I can say that, you know, the three people that I spoke with are all African American and actually represent the traditional 4-year institutions, Temple, as well as City College in New York. But also the community college in Virginia, who actually got there after going to a more of a for-profit trade school to learn how to be a nurse.
I see.
That's with my Cynthia Jones. So I think I have a good cross-section there. But I think the key here, and just in deference to the story we heard earlier from Ms. Dreyfus about the medical assistant, is I think it's about better career counseling. I don't necessarily know if going to an NYU, for instance, to become that type of training, maybe that wasn't the best career option. Perhaps going to a trade school that might have been a little bit less expensive might have been a better option.
I think you misunderstood the story. She was pre-med. She wanted to go to medical school. But she chose to go to a private college because her family said private will do you better. She now says to me she wishes she'd gone to Stony Brook like the people she went to high school with because they're in medical school. She didn't choose to be a medical assistant.
Well, how these colleges sell themselves in terms of long-term value is another huge issue here, but I'm afraid we're not going to have time. I'm sorry, Dara, we're not going to have time to get into this. We actually have a huge line of callers, a lot of people listening who have who have something to say about this issue, and there's another voice to talk about the long-term impacts that I do want to get into the conversation. But first, let us turn to Monica, who's calling from Swampscott. You're on the air, Monica.
Hi. I'm African-American. And I'm 30, and I first went into university. I went to a state university in California, which is where I'm from, and I was a journalism major, writer, and editor was my, you know, focus, and went through college 5.5 years it took me, and I accrued about, I would say, $20,000 in loans for that time. And after graduating, I graduated in 2003 and moved to New York. I had 2 internships. One was with the Village Voice in New York. Another one was with a major paper in California. And, you know, really trying to work and work up to is breaking into that field.
But I'm hearing a butt coming, though.
But I never did. And so, like, after sending out resumes and, you know, all kinds of, you know, clips and everything, never broke in. You know, the journalism, of course, the print field was going downhill.
So, Monica, did you go back to school?
I did. I went back to school in 2008, and I became a massage therapist.
And so how much is your overall loan burden now?
It's probably $30,000 to $35,000.
And are you working at the moment?
I am working.
Okay.
But I'm working, and I'm, you know, pretty much paycheck to paycheck to take care of myself.
Monica, thank you so much for your call. I'm sorry to interrupt, but it's just that your story, I think, is a perfect one for me to use to introduce our next guest, who is Derek Price. He is director of DVP Praxis and author of Borrowing Inequality, Race, Class, and Student Loans. Derek Price, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Meghna. Glad to be here.
You know, Monica's story, and she you know, went to school for one thing, journalism, couldn't get a job there, went back to school, now has $35,000 in overall loan debt. I mean, I read statistics here from the College Board that say in 2010, for example, black students with a bachelor's degree were way more likely to have more than $30,000 in debt, much like Monica, than their white peers or their Latino peers, you know, roughly twice as many. So there seems to be a lot of indication that in order to make it to that four-year level, black students have to or are borrowing more overall than other students. What do you see is the long-term impact of this amassing of debt for minority students?
Well, the real challenge here, people have already on the phone mentioned it in the context of default, but really the challenge here is the ability for a college graduate, a minority student, who's borrowed money to get a baccalaureate degree and a middle-class lifestyle, to pay it back without it being a huge burden to them. This is an issue, a concept of debt burden. So we get sometimes off track when we focus solely on the amount of debt, and by any measure, these debt averages and medians have grown considerably over the last decade and even longer. But the real issue is what burden that debt places on a student, and that gets to the question of employment, which I think is very topical given the jobless recovery, if you will, that is going on right now.
Mm. And so with this question of employment, I mean, there's been a long-term impact a long-term impact going forward in this current recession. I mean, we've read reports from the National Urban League that says 30 years of economic gains for minorities have basically been wiped away with this huge unemployment problem today. And yet, at the same time, my mind keeps coming back to the fact that what are students to do? I mean, an education is the way to take that step up. So what should they be trying to do in the next 3 to 5 years?
Well, that's a great question, Meghna. And you know, there's a philosophical strand here that Claudia has raised about whether we should expect students to borrow as much money to pay for college. But this has been a 25-year-old shift that started back in the 1980s to shift the overall cost of college increasingly to the consumer, the buyer, the student, so that they're paying a larger share either through borrowing money or through payment of tuition directly. But it doesn't deny the fact that the colleges and policymakers can make that shift because the college education is precisely what people need to do to position themselves more favorably in the labor market. And if I was a student, if I was a student right now, there are some important pieces here about borrowing. If you are going to go to a four-year institution that's requiring you to borrow money to help pay the tuition mm-hmm. and to cover living expenses, you've got to make sure you borrow money from the right place.
That place being the federal government?
Critical. Absolutely. The federal family, the educational loan program, which recently changed, the federal government is now directly providing capital to students to pay for college. These are both subsidized and unsubsidized loans directly from the federal government, and they come with certain consumer protections, for example, and also with low interest rates,
which you wouldn't get in the private loan market.
That is correct, mm-hmm. and that's really the big shift here. So a student who's borrowing money today needs to take the time and the energy, and it is an onerous one, mm-hmm. to complete the federal application for a free application for federal student aid or FAFSA. They must complete this so they can qualify for the cheapest student loans around, and that is from the federal government. They can be subsidized if you fall below a certain income level. And there are also unsubsidized student loans mm-hmm. from the federal government, which are also preferable to a private sector loan.
Derek Price, let me jump. I do forgive me, please, for jumping in, but we are fast running out of time, and this is such a huge topic that we could talk about it for many hours, but I've got literally about 60 seconds left. And Claudia Dreyfus, I just wanted to turn the last question to you briefly. It doesn't seem to me, given the factors that we've talked about that are driving up these student loan, the cost of an education and the amount of debt that students have to take, it doesn't seem that we can turn this tide anytime soon. Do you have a sense as to things that can be done?
Well, I think there are things individuals can do, but some of them are systemic. I think leaders in universities and colleges have to put a cap on the kind of amenities and the sense that the students will always pay because they can get loans.
On that note, Ms. Dreyfus,
expansion needs to stop, and we have to concentrate on basics.
I'm afraid I can't let you continue. Forgive me. I literally have 30 seconds left, but thank you so much for joining us. Claudia Dreyfus is co-author of Higher Education. Also, my thanks to Dara Sharif, freelance journalist for The Root, Joseph Moore, president of Lesley University, and Derek Price, author of Borrowing Inequality. Continue this conversation, listeners, please, on our website, radioboston.org. Up next, a controversy over showing of the 24-hour film called The Clock at Boston's MFA. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in with Adam Ragusea in for Anthony Brooks today. This is Radio Boston.